And celebrating birthdays for April 27th, we have Bernadine Hervey from Webster, Iowa. Happy birthday, Bernadine. We have Florence Pontarelli in Williamsburg. Happy birthday, Florence. We have Jeanette Merrill in Allison. Happy birthday, Jeanette. And we have Roy E. Stetzel in Creston. Happy birthday, Roy E. And in other news, we have our obituaries for today. This one for Teresa Finken, this from Iowa City. On Friday, April 12th, 2024, Dr. Teresa Finken passed away peacefully at her home in Iowa City, Iowa. A celebration of life open house will be held at the Heights rooftop in Iowa City on June 8th, 2024, from 2 to 5 p.m. In lieu of flowers, please send a donation to Tapestry Farms, a local nonprofit Teresa donated her time and resources to. And now to continue some of the largest things in Iowa, Ella.
The world's largest pickleball paddle. Besides playing pickleball and arcade games and enjoying the bar at West Des Moines Smash Park, you can also stare in awe at the world's largest pickleball paddle. Known as Big Blue by the employees and guests at Smash Park, the paddle weighs 150 pounds and is more than 13 feet tall, 10 times larger than the average paddle. Confirmed by Guinness World Records in 2018, the paddle isn't the only world's biggest thing at Smash Park. It also has the world's largest outdoor patio. The world's largest popcorn ball. With a height of 18 feet, the world's largest popcorn ball calls Sac City home. This isn't the first time Iowa has been home to the largest popcorn ball. Sac City has come together four times in the past 30 years to keep the record upheld. This particular attempt to keep the record in Iowa was put together in 2016 and weighs 3,970 pounds and could, hypothetically, be edible. The popcorn ball has its own home, completely encased to preserve its legacy and probably to not be eaten. There also is a village and a museum. You can see the popcorn ball around an hour west of Interstate 35 in Sac City in northern Iowa. The world's largest strawberry. No, you can't eat this one. This 15-foot-tall strawberry resides in the aptly named Strawberry Point, located not too far from the Wisconsin border. This fiberglass strawberry was put up in the 1960s after a local ad agency designed it. An hour from Iowa's eastern border and 20 minutes north of Manchester, which is right off US 20, you too can indulge in seeing this delicious-looking strawberry. The world's largest Swedish coffee pot and coffee cup. While it no longer looms over Stanton, the world's second largest Swedish coffee pot still calls the small town home. The coffee pot was dethroned in the 1990s after a slightly larger one, with a difference of only 10,000 gallons, was erected in Kingsburg, California. The town's water tower was transformed in 1971, dedicated to Virginia Christine, also known as Mrs. Olson, from Folger's coffee commercials back in the day. What does loom over the just shy of 700 people in town is the world's largest Swedish coffee cup, which acts as the town's current water tower. Iowa 80, the world's largest truck stop. Located just 20 minutes away from the Quad Cities in the world's largest truck stop, is the world's largest truck stop, Iowa 80. With more than 130,000 square feet, Iowa 80 is home to everything from a Dairy Queen to a dog groomer and even a chiropractor. Now celebrating its 60th anniversary this year, what some call a trucker's Disneyland has 8 restaurants, a convenience store, a gift store, and more for truckers, travelers, and world's largest enthusiasts to enjoy. Open 24/7, the world's largest truck stop is a metropolis like no other. And finally, the world's largest wooden nickel. While Iowa isn't home to the largest nickel in the world, Greater Sudbury in Ontario, Canada holds that record, it is home to the largest wooden nickel, just a stone's throw away from Interstate 80. The wooden nickel, with a diameter of 16 feet, bears the etching of a buffalo with the phrases, "Don't tread on me," and "Vote for common sense." It was originally built by Iowa City local Jim Glasgow in 2006, a time of protest against the widening and redevelopment of the highway right next to where the nickel stands. The building of the nickel was a not-so-subtle insinuation that the county's proposal was not worth a wooden nickel. Built of yellow pine and steel rods, the nickel has endured 18 years of weathering, yet still stands strong as one of Iowa's most unique and world records.
And my apologies for missing this reminder, but you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Public Radio Information Service. If you are hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And back to more local news. College athletes sue Iowa investigators over conduct in sports betting inquiry. 25 former University of Iowa and Iowa State athletes and a former community college player sued state law enforcement leaders Friday, alleging that investigators illegally inspected their cell phone use in a high-profile sports betting probe. In a federal lawsuit, attorneys for the athletes said Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation agents violated the U.S. Constitution by failing to get warrants before using software to check whether people opened betting apps inside university athletic buildings. Known as Kibana, the software revealed the DraftKings and FanDuel account numbers that people used inside the buildings. Based on that information, agents obtained warrants that required the sports books to reveal the registered users for those accounts, as well as their betting activity. Prosecutors charged 26 athletes with underage gambling or identity theft, based on evidence that they used accounts registered to their parents and friends. In Friday's lawsuit, the athletes' attorneys contend that the 4th and 14th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution prohibit police from using Kibana without a warrant. The athletes have sued the state, the Iowa Department of Public Safety, the DCI, and several agency officials. Quote, due to DCI's actions and or failures to legally investigate the plaintiffs were all indicted and some were convicted, severely upending their lives, collegiate careers, and future opportunities, end quote, wrote the lawyers Matt Bowles and Van Plum in filing in the Southern District of Iowa. The 26 plaintiffs include former Iowa State quarterback Hunter Deckers, Iowa defensive lineman Noah Shannon, and Iowa State defensive end Yuma Iwazirik, whom the Denver Broncos drafted in 2022. The NFL suspended Iwazirik last year, following news of the investigation, which revealed that he bet on Iowa State and Broncos games while a member of both teams. Other plaintiffs include basketball players, baseball players, and wrestlers. Some of the plaintiffs did not face criminal charges as a result of the probe, but the NCAA suspended all of them for at least one season. The Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission stated last August that the investigation did not reveal evidence of point shaving, a practice in which athletes alter their performances to influence the outcome of bets. The suits also claim investigators misled players. In addition to accusing the DCI of illegally using bet tracking software, the players' attorneys said several agents misled athletes during the investigation. In previous criminal court filings, the lawyers said DCI Special Agent Mark Ludwig testified that he had been misled about the nature of the investigation. Ludwig allegedly said that a DCI supervisor informed him that the investigators were probing whether sportsbooks were abiding by Iowa laws, which require the books to prevent athletes from betting on their games. In turn, Ludwig allegedly testified. He told Iowa State defensive lineman Isaiah Lee during an interview that Lee was not under investigation. Prosecutors later charged Lee with identity theft. In Friday's lawsuit, the players' lawyers said other investigators misled players. Quote, Multiple DCI agents told plaintiffs they were not the targets of the investigation, but instead were only assisting in the investigation into the various sports betting companies, the lawyers wrote. Asked about the new allegation in an email Friday, Bowles told the Des Moines Register that the other agents made those statements in depositions, which the lawyers have not publicly released. Bowles did not name those investigators. Quote, several of the agents were told it was an action against DraftKings and FanDuel as the agents went about collecting the phones from the athletes, he said. Experts cast doubt on Fourth Amendment claim. Of the 26 athletes charged in the case, 19 pleaded guilty to underage gambling. A Story County prosecutor dropped charges against a former Iowa defensive tight end after the prosecutor's office missed a deadline to turn over a copy of the indictment against the athlete last fall. The prosecutor dropped charges against five former Iowa State athletes in March following the revelation that GeoComply, the provider of the Kibana software that DCI agents used, cut off investigators' access to the tool in the wake of negative public reaction to the betting cases. A GeoComply employee wrote in a January 25th email to the Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission that the DCI agents, quote, may have exceeded the intended and outlined scope of its Kibana access and use and privileges. GeoComply, which contracts with major sports books to track the location of their users, has not responded to multiple requests for comment from the Register, including an email Friday. In March, after the Story County prosecutor dismissed charges because of the GeoComply news, DPS Commissioner Stephen Baines defended the investigators, writing in a statement that, quote, throughout the investigation, agents conferred with legal experts, end quote. Internal emails that the Register obtained through records requests show GeoComply employees encouraged DCI agents to use Kibana to investigate illegal sports betting. The company trained DCI agents multiple times in 2022, with GeoComply staff traveling to Des Moines for an in-person session in November of that year. The company worked with law enforcement agencies in other states, too. Emails revealed that GeoComply hosted monthly conference calls for police agencies, explaining how they could use the software to spot potentially illegal bets. GeoComply officials suggested that investigators look for bets in areas where gambling shouldn't occur, such as in prisons or high schools. According to an internal memo from DCI Special Agent Brian Sanger, who led the sports betting probe, a GeoComply employee also coached Iowa officials on how to write regulations that would let the company turn over information without a warrant. GeoComply asked the Gaming Commission for permission before sharing Kibana with the DCI. After a call with Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Peterzelik in August 2022, then Gaming Commission Director Brian Ohorilko told GeoComply they could give the tool to the DCI. Orrin Kerr, a University of California, Berkeley law professor and Fourth Amendment expert, told the Register that the DCI's investigation did not appear to constitute an illegal search. Sports betting users agreed to let the app providers like DraftKings and FanDuel share their location. The providers then agreed to give the data to GeoComply, which agreed to give the information to law enforcement. Kerr said Fourth Amendment disputes center on whether the government can take evidence that a person tries to keep private. So who's suing whom? In addition to Deckers, Lee, Shannon, and Uwazirik, the plaintiffs in the lawsuit are Iowa baseball players Keaton Anthony, Gehrig Christensen, Jacob Henderson, and Benjamin Tallman, Iowa wrestlers Abe Assad, Nelson Brands, Tony Cassiope, Patrick Kennedy, Cullen Shriver, and Kobe Siebrecht, Iowa football players Aaron Blom, Harry Bracey, Arlen Bruce IV, and Jack Johnson, Iowa State football players Gerald Brock, Howard Brown, Deshaun Hanica, Jake Remsburg, and Dodge Saucer, Ellsworth Community College baseball player Jake English, Iowa basketball player Aaron Ullis, Iowa State basketball player Jeremiah Williams. In addition to the state, the DPS, and the DCI, the defendants are Baines, the DPS commissioner, Sanger, the DCI agent who led the investigation, DCI Director Paul Feddersen, Assistant DCI Director Jacob Jobes, Troy Nelson, Special Agent in charge of the DCI's Sports Wagering Unit. Back to Ella.
Johnston City School Board okays property tax increases. Johnston homeowners could pay more in taxes this year after the school district and the city both raised their tax rates. The Johnston City Council on April 15th approved the city's budget for the 2025 fiscal year, which begins July 1st. The budget includes a property tax rate of about $11.44 for every $1,000 of a home's value, which is an increase of about 58 cents from last year's rate of $10.86. The Johnston Community School District approved its budget April 22nd with a property tax rate of about $13.89 for every $1,000 of a home's value, which is an increase of about 88 cents from last year's rate of $13.01. The new school district rate is still near $4.50, lower than it was 5 years ago, while the city rate remains 21 cents lower from the same time period. The school tax rate reached $18.35 in 2019 and dropped sharply last year after the district paid off debt for the new high school over a decade early. The city rate in 2019 was $11.65. Property tax bills are calculated as a dollar amount for every $1,000 of a property's assessed value. Separate governing entities, in particular the city, the school district, and the county, set their own rates for their parts of the total tax bill. Home values in Polk County have increased by an average of 22%, but the state also reduced the rollback rate, or the percentage of a home's value that is actually taxed, from about 57% to 46%. An individual homeowner's final tax bill amount will depend on the value of their home and how much it has increased over the past year, if at all. Alongside the city and school budgets, Polk County approved its budget April 23rd, that keeps the tax rate for urban taxpayers the same at $6.77. In Johnston, the owner of a $300,000 home that has increased 20% in value to $360,000 could see the taxes they pay to the city, schools, and county go from $5,022 to $5,354, an increase of $332 for the year. There will be other tax rates on a property owner's bill for Des Moines Area Community College, Des Moines Area Regional Transit, and other public agencies. Homeowners who live outside the Johnston City or School District boundaries will see different rate breakdowns, including Urbandale City residents who are in the Johnston School District. A school district's tax levy is made up of several components. One piece is the cash reserve, which can help cover costs like the special education deficit, English as a second language programs, and cash flow. According to budget information presented at school board meetings, the district levied $0 in taxes for its cash reserve in 2023, as it ran up against state limits. State law restricts how much taxes school districts can levy for its cash reserve relative to total expenses, which can limit the amount of unspent cash districts have on hand. Officials expected the tax rate to increase once the district was able to levy taxes for the cash reserve again in 2024. Meanwhile, Johnston's certified enrollment county of resident students decreased by about 150 students, which reduces state funding. However, the district used a provision in Iowa law to make up the difference through property taxes, which added 12 cents to the rate. Johnston's total number of students served was actually higher than last year due to open enrollment, according to state data. The $13.89 rate was the lowest recommended by district staff and remains lower than most comparable districts, according to information presented to the school board. Board members said the district has been financially responsible while providing services and competing as an employer, while lowering the rate could mean outcomes like larger class sizes and lower teacher salaries. Meanwhile, according to information presented to the Johnston City Council, funding challenges included higher costs and pressure from inflation, which new construction from 2023 may not yet be on the tax rolls. Challenges in state law meant to help taxpayers also have limited city revenue and financial flexibility. Quote, "This was a difficult budget year as we experienced increased costs and inflation pressures, which our residents are also experiencing," end quote, Johnston Mayor Paula Deerenfield said in a news release. "The fiscal year 2025 budget reflects our city's strong commitment to investing in the future of our community while prioritizing public safety. The budget we approved provides the funding necessary to support the high-quality services our residents expect and meet the demands of our growing community. Overall, the budget balances the needs for our city and ensures the fiscal responsibility as we move into the future. The city budget includes funding for 2 new police officers, a new mechanic, a recreation coordinator to support the upcoming Ignit Youth Sports Facility, Northwest Sewer Extension, a new fire truck, and a new ambulance."
Thank you, Ella. And this is our last story from local news. Remains found of Iowa teen missing since 2018. Missouri State Highway Patrol officials have identified human remains found by a hunter on Tuesday as a missing teen from Iowa. The Mercer County Sheriff's Office and the Missouri State Highway Patrol's Division of Drug and Crime Control were investigating the discovery of human remains on Tuesday afternoon and have identified the body as Sebastian Tyrese Husted of Centerville, officials said in a news release. Husted disappeared in January 2018. His sister, Aisha Husted, told the Register that year. He was 19 at the time. Husted's remains were discovered by a turkey hunter on a private property in northeast Mercer County in Missouri. Mercer County is located on the Missouri-Iowa border and is about 60 miles away from Centerville. And now on to Ella giving some short stories from around the world.
Pompeii still offers lessons. The city of Pompeii in southern Italy has taught us a lot about the lives of the ancient Romans. The discovery of this city, covered in a thick blanket of ash and smoke after the nearby Mount Vesuvius volcano erupted in 79 CE, has allowed the development of modern archaeology, researchers say. And 2 centuries after its ruins were discovered, Pompeii still offers new surprises. Archaeologists at the World Heritage Site recently uncovered a banquet room with frescoes that tell a romanticized story of the Trojan War. The Washington Post reported, "The banquet room gave archaeologists a more precise idea of the lavish life that wealthy Romans enjoyed. Entertainment was at the center of it. Surrounded by depictions of the Helen of Troy and Paris, Cassandra and Apollo, rich Pompeians would gather for suppers where Campanian wine flowed. Walls were painted black to hide evidence of smoke coming from oil lamps. At night, the flickering light of the lamps had the effect of making the images appear to move, especially for those who have had one too many drinks," one researcher told Washington Post. "The characters on the walls came from stories that remain famous today, featured in Homer's Iliad and the Odyssey. They testify to ancient Greek and Roman sensitivity to conversations about the past and life. Though some discoveries in Pompeii tell how beautiful life could be for the Romans, others show the sheer inequalities of ancient Roman society," researchers have also found a prison bakery where enslaved people worked in harsh conditions, living with animals to supply baked goods to the wealthy.
And this from Slovakia, a broadcaster is targeted. The government of Slovakia on Wednesday approved a plan to abolish the country's public broadcaster as a part of a string of measures enhancing the state's control over its media, a move critics said would endanger the independence of the press, the BBC reported. Prime Minister Robert Fico said the bill was necessary because of questions over the broadcaster's neutrality. The proposal triggered protests last month on the streets of the capital, Bratislava, and outrage among local journalists, opposition politicians, and international observers. Culture Minister and former reporter Martina Simakovokia, who introduced the plan, accused Radio and Television of Slovakia, RTVS, of pushing political activism and giving a platform only to mainstream opinion. The broadcaster has denied the allegations. RTVS will be replaced by a new organization called Slovak Television and Radio, STVR. The current director general of RTVS will be sacked, and a 5-member council appointed by ministers and parliament will handpick his replacement. Last month, the European Broadcasting Union, the world's largest public media alliance, criticized the proposal, saying it would breach the European Union's Media Freedom Act. Simkovikova insisted the most recent version of the bill complied with the EU legislation after being stripped of some of its most controversial components, including the creation of a council to manage editorial decisions, described by critics as outright censorship. Meanwhile, 1,200 RTVS staff members signed a petition against the proposal, while 80,000 people signed an open letter to the EU in support of RTVS, The Guardian reported. And a short story from Japan reconsidering defense policies. A recent survey found that more than 92% of Japanese respondents held unfavorable views of China, an increase of almost 5% compared with last year. The Japan Times reported, the findings hold lessons about geopolitics in Asia, specifically the shift in Japan's increasingly robust military posture. Since World War II, when the country surrendered to the U.S. after 2 nuclear attacks, Japan has ostensibly pacifist policies under its constitution. Under a 1960 treaty with the U.S., for example, American forces must intervene to defend Japan in the event of war, but Japan has no commitment obligation, no concomitant obligation, London University Asian expert Paul O'Shea and Sendai Shirayuri, Women's College Professor of International Relations Sebastian Maslow explained in the conversation. Now, however, as Russia tramples over Ukrainian sovereignty and many suspect China is considering an invasion of Taiwan, Japanese leaders are reconsidering their defense policies. Quote, Japan is slowly heading toward a forward-looking defense posture that would have been unimaginable in the not-too-distant past, wrote Japan Forward, adding that the country was increasing its military budget to 2% of gross domestic product, putting it on track to become the third biggest military spender globally after the U.S. and China. As its new carriers come online, the Japanese Navy will arguably tip the balance between U.S.-led forces and China in the event of a confrontation over Taiwan, the Telegraph added. These moves aren't isolated to Asia or the Pacific. Japan, for instance, has also become a major financial donor to Ukraine and might supply weapons, risking the ire of Russian President Vladimir Putin, Dushwell reported. Many Japanese citizens, wary of the destruction their nation has suffered and perpetuated on others in the past, are not keen on Prime Minister Fumio Kishida's plans. Americans like Rahm Emanuel, the U.S. ambassador to Japan, disagree. In a Washington Post op-ed, Emanuel argued that Kishida and his allies realize that Japan can't separate itself from the rest of the dangerous world, especially when its giant neighbor could become more aggressive in the near future. For the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Justin and Ella Gibson. It's been our pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Lisa Horsch and Nicholas Herder. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Here's Lisa for our next article.
All right, looking at the Nation and World extras, we'll start there. Russia's support, Taiwan, tensions among key issues in Blinken's talks with China. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi and Chinese leader Xi Jinping in Beijing on Friday, in the latest high-level contacts between the superpowers aimed at keeping tense relations under control. The visit brought little progress on contentious issues, including China's support for Russia in Ukraine, tensions over Taiwan and the South China Sea, and U.S. complaints about cheap Chinese exports. However, there was some effort to ease the mood by emphasizing educational and other cultural exchanges. Here are some of the details of these issues. China's support for Russia. Blinken raised concerns about China's support for Russia's military, saying its supply of so-called dual-use goods was having a material effect in Ukraine and raising the threat Russia poses to countries in Europe. China is the top supplier of machine tools, microelectronics, nitrocellulose, which is critical to making munitions and rocket propellants and other dual-use items that Moscow was using to ramp up its defense industrial base, Blinken told a news conference. He did not respond when asked whether Washington would impose sanctions over China's support for Russia, which U.S. officials warn risks hurting the broader bilateral relationship, even as ties stabilize. China says it has not provided weaponry or to any party, and that it is not a producer of or party involved in the Ukraine crisis. However, it says that normal trade between China and Russia should not be interrupted or restricted. Taiwan. China's top diplomat, Wang Yi, said the U.S. must not step on red lines covering sovereignty, security and development interests, an apparent reference to Taiwan, the democratically governed island China claims as its own, and the disputed South China Sea. Russia's Ukraine invasion has raised fears China might be emboldened to move against Taiwan, which the U.S. is required by law to provide with the means to defend itself. President Joe Biden, who met Xi Jinping in November in San Francisco, says Washington does not support Taiwan's independence, but has upset Beijing by appearing to suggest it would defend the island if it were attacked, underscoring the discord. Hours before Blinken landed in China on Wednesday, Biden signed a bill that included an $8 billion to counter China's military might, as well as billions in defense aid for Taiwan and $61 billion for Ukraine. Economic relations. China and the United States are the world's two largest economies and still have robust trade sales. These have been hit by U.S. concerns about the size of its trade deficit with China, Washington's imposition of restrictions on trade in goods that could bolster China's military, and efforts to diversify supply chains away from China since the COVID-19 pandemic. Wang said the U.S. has taken endless measures to suppress China's economy, trade, science, and technology, equating each step to containment. Xi reiterated Beijing's concerns that the U.S. was suppressing its economic development. This is a fundamental issue that must be addressed, just like the first button of a shirt that must be put right in order for the China-U.S. relationship to truly stabilize, improve, and move forward, Xi said. Drugs. Curbing China's supply of the chemicals used to make fentanyl, a killer drug having a devastating effect among American youth, has been a top U.S. priority. During his three-day trip, Blinken met China's Minister of Public Security, Wang Xiaohong, to discuss the issue. He said China has made some progress dealing with what he called the number one killer of Americans between the ages of 18 and 45, but more needs to be done. And finally, people-to-people ties. To lighten the mood for days of serious engagement, Blinken popped into a Beijing record store and bought an album by Chinese rocker Duo Ye Wei and Taylor Swift's Midnights. One of the aims of his trip has been to emphasize the importance of people-to-people ties in improving relations. Blinken, a keen musician and guitar player, described music as the best connector regardless of geography. He also said Xi has said he wanted to significantly increase the number of American students in China. Blinken said there are more than 290,000 Chinese students in the United States, but fewer than 900 Americans studying in China.
India election turnout falls in second phase. India held the second phase of the world's biggest election on Friday, with Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his rivals hurling accusations of religious discrimination and threats to democracy amid flagging voter turnout. Almost 1 billion people are eligible to vote in the seven-phase general election that began on April 19th and concludes on June 1st, with votes set to be counted on June 4th. Modi is seeking a historic third straight term on the back of his economic record, welfare measures, national pride, Hindu nationalism, and personal popularity. Surveys suggest he will easily win a comfortable majority. His challengers have formed an alliance of more than two dozen parties and are promising greater affirmative action, more handouts, and an end to what they call Modi's autocratic rule. A total of 88 seats out of the 543 in the lower house of parliament went to the polls on Friday, with 160 million people eligible to vote across 13 states and federal territories. Approximate voter turnout data at the end of polling put Friday's turnout at 61%, lower than the 65% in the first phase last week and 68% in the second phase 5 years back. The Election Commission and political parties are concerned that unseasonably hot weather and wetting in some parts of the country would affect turnout. Analysts say that there is no single issue strong enough to pull voters out this time, and the committed Hindu nationalist base of Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP, may not be stepping out due to complacency or overconfidence, resulting in lower turnout. More than half the seats in Friday's contests were in the southern states of Kerala and Karnataka and the northwestern state of Rajasthan. The campaign has become more heated since the first phase of voting on April 19th, as Modi and the main opposition Congress party have faced on communal issues, with Modi accusing Congress of favoring minority Muslims, aiming to dilute affirmative action, and planning to impose an inheritance tax. Congress has denied the charges and said Modi fears losing and was using divisive language to distract voters from real issues such as unemployment, rising prices, and rural distress. But some voters were responding to the BJP. "I will vote for BJP. Muslims will get a lot of benefits if Congress comes to power, and I don't want taxpayers' money to go any one community," said Sri Harry, SS23, who voted in the tech hub of Bengaluru. Others were not happy with what they said was a sectarian shift in politics. BJP is using temples and mosaics to create a divide between Hindus and Muslims to move away from real issues such as unemployment and rising prices, said Sokin Qureshi, 29, an unemployed Muslim voter in the northern city of Mathura. Rahul Gandhi, a former Congress president and the face of the party, was among the 1,200 candidates hoping to be elected on Friday. This election is not a regular election because of the because for the first time in the history of India, one party and one person is trying to finish the constitution and democracy of India, Gandhi said at an election rally in a region of Karnataka, which votes next week. Gandhi is seeking re-election from Wayanad in Kerala and faces Annie Raja of the Communist Party of India, CPI, and BJP's K. Surendran, among others, in the left-front-ruled state. In 2019, Gandhi defeated the CPI candidate by more than 400,000 votes, the highest margin in Kerala, although he lost his second seat to BJP in the family bastion of Amethi in North India. India allows a candidate to contest more than one seat, but they can keep only one if they record multiple victories. Congress slumped to a historic low when it was swept out by the power of BJP in 2014 and won its second lowest number of seats, 52, in 2019, with Kerala contributing to the highest tally of 15. The party is expected to do better in Karnataka this year, where it won just one of 28 seats in 2019, but gained strength and defeated BJP in the state elections last year. It is still seen to be struggling nationally as bickering within the opposition alliance it leads and graft cases against some leaders has hobbled its challenge to Modi. Phase 2 has been too good, Modi posted on X after voting closed. The unparalleled support for NDA is going to disappoint the opposition even more, he said, referring to his BJP-led ruling National Democratic Alliance.
U.S. tests show pasteurized milk is safe as bird flu spreads. This is written by Julie Steenhuisen and Tom Polinsek for the Reuters. Additional tests of milk showed that pasteurization killed the bird flu virus, federal health officials said on Friday, as Colorado became the ninth state to report an infected dairy herd. Federal lawmakers urged the Biden administration to further contain the virus's spread, as tests showed 1 in 5 U.S. commercial milk samples contained remnants of the virus, suggesting the outbreak is more widespread than previously thought. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration laid on Friday, and preliminary results from gold standard PCR tests showed pasteurization killed the virus in milk and baby formula. It did not say how many milk products it had tested, but added that it planned to do more testing on 297 products from 38 states. One person, a Texas farm worker, has been confirmed to have bird flu and suffered conjunctivitis in the current outbreak following exposure to dairy cows. Both the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the World Health Organization said on Friday the current overall public health risk is low, but it is higher for those with exposure to infected animals. The U.S. Department of Agriculture confirmed milking cows in Colorado tested positive following earlier infections in Texas, Kansas, Michigan, Ohio, Idaho, New Mexico, North Carolina, and South Dakota. Congress members' push for a stronger response added pressure on federal agriculture and health authorities still seeking to confirm how the H5N1 virus is spreading and its potential risk to people, 1 month after the first detection in a Texas dairy herd. An analysis of U.S. Department of Agriculture data by a University of Arizona scientist offers new evidence that the first known H5N1 outbreak in dairy cattle is more far-reaching than the 34 herds in 9 states that have officially tested positive. Containing this before it spreads among humans is critical. Given lessons learned from COVID, this federal response is insufficient, Republican U.S. Senator Mitt Romney said in a post on X. Some lawmakers, including Romney, have made a bipartisan push to reauthorize legislation known as the Pandemic and All Hazards Preparedness Act that lapsed last year and is aimed at bolstering the nation's response to pandemics and other public health threats. The recent spread of bird flu and the detection of H5N1 genetic materials in milk have increased some calls for action. The virus in the human case is significantly different from the bird flu virus samples taken from infected cattle that were made public by government officials last week, said Dr. Michael Worby, an evolutionary biologist from the University of Arizona. The difference between the genetic sequences of the workers' virus and the 239 other samples provided indicate that this was a very long-standing widespread epidemic, he told Reuters. The Texas Animal Health Commission said it did not receive the location of the worker's farm or obtain samples of that herd to test because of the person's confidentiality. I think the sequences out there probably aren't representative of everything that's circulating, said Dr. Richard Webby, a virologist at St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital in Memphis. A CDC spokesperson said in an email, there are always some subtle changes in genetic sequences when flu viruses move from host to host, but said data points to the virus emerging from birds to infect cows and then transmission to humans. One in five commercial milk samples tested in a nationwide survey contained particles of the H5N1 virus, the FDA said late on Thursday. The agency said there's no reason to believe the virus found in milk poses a risk to human health, and on Friday described results of the new tests. This says this virus has largely saturated dairy cattle throughout the country, said Dr. Michael Osterholm, an infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota. Many infectious disease experts and government officials have said they believe the pasteurization process will inactivate the virus, also known as avian influenza. I'm not worried about the milk itself, said Samuel Alkane, associate professor of food science at Cornell University. It does indicate that the virus is more widespread among dairies than we had previously thought. Osterholm said the U.S. should be doing much more sampling in both dairy and beef cattle, as well as pigs. Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, a significant dairy state with no reported cases, has urged the USDA to quickly deploy additional resources in states that have the opportunity to prevent the disease from entering herds. The White House has said that it is monitoring the avian flu situation, launching an immediate response team to ensure the safety of the nation's food supply, monitor trends to mitigate risk, and prevent the virus's spread. Starting on Monday, the USDA will require dairy cows to test negative for bird flu before they are moved across state lines. In Indiana, officials are weighing their own potential restrictions, such as testing within the state, though it has no confirmed cases, said Brett Marsh, the state veterinarian. We're taking a look here at the state level to see what we may need to do, he said on a conference call.
Biden administration delays plan to ban menthol cigarettes. The Biden administration on Friday delayed its plan to ban menthol cigarettes, a move that reflected the potential for a political backlash from black voters in an election year. For decades, menthol cigarettes have been in the crosshairs of anti-smoking groups who argue that they contribute to the disproportionate health burdens on black communities and play a role in luring young people into smoking. About 81% of black adults who have smoked cigarettes used menthol varieties, compared with 34% of white adults, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Xavier Becerra said in a statement that the proposed ban had brought immense feedback, including from parts of the civil rights and criminal justice movement. It's clear that there are still more conversations to have, and that will take significantly more time, he said, in a statement that appeared to suggest it would not be sorted before the presidential election in November. Shares of tobacco companies were muted following the news. Altria Group and British American Tobacco closed down marginally, while Imperial Brands shared ended nearly 1% lower. NAACP President Derek Johnson said his organization was outraged and disgusted by the political move. In an election year, politicians should be prioritizing people, not profiteers. Today's news from the Biden administration is a blow to the black community, who continue to be unfairly targeted and unjustly killed by Big Tobacco, he said. Nancy Brown, CEO of the American Heart Association, also expressed dismay over the delay. 2 full years after releasing proposed rules backed by extensive scientific evidence, and more than a decade since the FDA began examining menthol cigarettes, the administration has failed to take decisive action to remove these deadly addictive products from the market. We strongly believe there are more effective ways to transition adult smokers away from cigarettes permanently, said a spokesperson for Reynolds American, a subsidiary of British American Tobacco. The spokesperson said that providing access to nicotine alternatives such as vaping products are critical in supporting adult smokers to migrate from combustible cigarettes. Menthol cigarettes account for a third of the industry's overall market share in the United States. A highly addictive product have Addictive products have been cited for their appeal to young smokers, as well as significant health impacts for black communities. Civil rights groups have contended for years that menthol cigarettes pose a disproportionately higher risk in black communities where they are heavily marketed. Yolanda Richardson, president of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, said last month that research showed eliminating menthol cigarettes would cut the number of young people who start smoking, increase the number of smokers who quit, and save up to 654,000 lives within 40 years, including 255,000 black lives. Now it is time for Dear Abby. Newlyweds butt heads over career family choices. Dear Abby, I am a teacher, I have a young son, and I love being off when he is out for school holidays and spending summers together. I feel I have the best of both worlds. I recently married a woman who is 14 years younger than me and is also a teacher. My wife hates the profession. She feels it isn't exciting or respectable enough. Her options about teaching hurt my feelings because I believe it is a noble career. Plus, it gives me quality time with my son. My wife has decided to join the police force. It didn't happen out of the blue. We have discussed it for the last 5 years. I've told her it isn't the life I want. I worked hard to reach a point in my life to have a family and take summer vacations with my son. I was honest with her. From the beginning, she often says she wants time with our family too, and that she won't join the police force. Then, days later, she brings it up again. We have been married only 6 months, but I regret it already. I didn't get married to be alone all the time and to take vacations without my spouse. I love her, but I feel betrayed and lied to. I also don't think she'll be a good cop. She is just obsessed with police shows and thinks it's going to be like that. She's throwing away a great career for one I think she'll leave in a year or two. I feel our biggest challenge is her lack of experience. What do I do? Signed, Worried in Life / Mom in Florida.
We'll do one brief news story, and then we'll do the closed script here. South Dakota Governor Noem defends killing dog on the family farm. This is Dateline Washington. Kristi Noem, a contender to become Republican Donald Trump's vice presidential running mate, defended herself on Friday against Democratic attacks over her account of shooting a dog on her family farm. Noem, the governor of South Dakota, describes killing an untrainable dog called Cricket, which she hated, in an upcoming memoir, excerpts from which were first published by The Guardian on Friday. She also said she shot to death a goat. Noam said the dog ruined a hunt and later attacked chickens owned by a local family, behaved like a trained assassin, and was dangerous to anyone she came in contact with. I realized I had to put her down, Noam writes. The Democratic National Committee seized on the excerpts, calling them horrifying and disturbing. Responding on X, Noam said, "We love animals, but tough decisions like this happen all the time on a farm. Sadly, we just had to put down 3 horses a few weeks ago that had been in our family for 25 years. Noam is on a list of candidates being considered by Trump to be his running mate. Friends and allies of Trump have told the news organization.
Here's a reminder that you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. You can listen to a podcast of this and many other IRIS programs at iowaradioreading.org. It is time for a quick break and we'll return with more articles from the Des Moines Register.